from the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. This is Backstory with the American History Guys. In the summer of 1862, newspapers in the Confederate South had their eye on one northern nuisance, a Philadelphia shopkeeper named Samuel Upham.
He's not a criminal by any means.
This is author Ben Tarnoff.
He is a respectable businessman. You know, he runs a shop on Chestnut Street. He lives in a nice part of town.
But down south, he was hated.
Loathed, despised. And he was called out by name, actually, in many Confederate newspapers. They called him a knave swindler. They said that he represented Yankee scoundrelism.
And it wasn't only newspaper editors. Jefferson Davis himself warned the Confederate Congress about the threat that Upham represented. So what was it about this guy that bothered white Southerners so much?
Samuel Upham was one of the most notorious counterfeiters of Southern currency.
I'm Ed Ayers, and I'm here with fellow history guys Brian Ballow.
Hey there.
And Peter Onuf.
Hey, Ed.
And we should pause here to remind people that during the Civil War years, the very legitimacy of the Confederacy was at stake. They were saying, we are a real government. And the Union was saying, no, you're not real. We're the only true government here.
So the Confederacy's currency, known as the greyback, had huge symbolic value. If the greyback held its value in the marketplace, it would be a sign that Southerners believed the new government was a legitimate one, one with staying power. But the greyback also had a very practical value. It gave the Confederate government a means to pay for the war, and the war wasn't cheap.
The problem was there wasn't enough gold in the South to back the greyback. And so the more money the Confederacy pumped out, the less that money was worth. And the less it was worth, the more they needed to pump out to pay for things like weapons and soldiers' paychecks.
To make matters worse, they weren't the only ones printing money. As a government committed to states' rights, the rebels also let states and private banks print money. And even with the government notes, the printing work was being outsourced to engravers all over the South.
I think it's a note from September 1861 that has something like 229 distinct acceptable varieties.
With this dizzying array of legitimate banknotes in circulation, you can imagine how easy it was for illegitimate money to find its way into the mix.
Which brings us back to Samuel Upham. Originally, he had marketed his reproductions of greybacks in magazines as novelty items. But it didn't take long before those novelty items were being exchanged for real goods and services in the South. And when Upham realized that, he amped up his output, producing massive quantities of as many as 25 different notes. And he started making it very easy for people who had more instrumental motives in mind.
He offers a lot of appealing extras for someone who wants to use these as real counterfeits. For instance, for extra money, you can get your note printed on real banknote paper. You can also have the serial numbers and signatures omitted, which would be a major factor for a counterfeiter because you would need to forge those freshly on each note.
You might be wondering how Upham's money made its way into circulation. Well, part of the answer has to do with the workings of the black market trade in cotton. But the rest of it traveled south in the pockets of Union soldiers.
And that really contributed to a lot of anger in the South and a theory among many Southerners that this was actually a deliberate campaign of economic warfare that was being waged by Lincoln's government through Upham against the Confederacy.
Now, there's no evidence that the U.S. government was backing Upham, and Upham himself denied that he was a counterfeiter. But years later, he bragged that he had churned out $15 million in greybacks. And if that's true, his notes would have made up 3% of the Southern money supply.
Upham also inspired copycats, other Northerners who wanted to cash in on the market for facsimile greybacks. If there was a problem of too much cash in circulation before, well, all this fake money certainly didn't help. By the middle of 1863, the greyback was basically worthless.
One of the double-edged aspects of having all these Southern newspapers denouncing Upham so loudly is that they're also drawing attention to the fact that there's a Northern counterfeiter who is just forging a ton of Confederate money with impunity. I think that really does erode confidence.
It's hard to know how much to credit Samuel Upham with the erosion of confidence in the Confederate state. There were obviously a lot of factors at work, but it's certainly not a stretch to say that in this case, the value of money was a lot greater than the numbers printed on those little pieces of paper.
Yes, they're money, but they're also symbols of sovereignty. You know, they're emblazoned with all of these images and mottos that have to do with how these two nations think of themselves. And your confidence in them is almost a patriotic duty.
For the rest of the hour today on Backstory, we're going to be reflecting on the many layers of meaning that money has had in America and about how those meanings have shifted over time. We'll consider Benjamin Franklin's original idea for a national currency and look at what debates about the monetary system 100 years later had to do with the debates about the rights of former slaves.
We've been thinking about the way money acquires its value, frankly, because of the headlines we've been reading about Bitcoin. Bitcoin's that digital currency that makes it easy for people to do person-to-person financial transactions completely outside the purview of banks. Just about every week, it seems that there's a new company that jumps on the Bitcoin wagon. Beyond Bitcoin's growing usefulness in the marketplace, it seems that this new currency appeals on a much more fundamental level.
This is what makes Bitcoin, I think, so fundamentally fascinating.
This is Stephen Mim, an economic historian at the University of Georgia.
Most of the people who seem to be intent on using it, or many of them rather, I'll just say many, the reasons are not because it offers a medium of exchange or a store of value or a unit of account, the classic, you know, functions of money as defined by economists, but because it offers at last an alternative to state-controlled currencies. And for people of a libertarian bent who believe that the Fed is the creature from Jekyll Island, this ungainly, awful beast that has enslaved all of us to the will of central bankers, Bitcoin offers an antidote, finally.
But for Stephen Mim, this freedom from government control is hardly a recipe for success. In fact, he thinks it's the very thing that will ultimately do Bitcoin in. To understand why, he says we need to return to the period where we left off a few minutes ago, the 1860s. You see, private currencies weren't only a product of the South. They were flourishing in the North as well. By the eve of the Civil War, Mim says there were some 10,000 different paper currencies in circulation.
The reason that this has a lesson for Bitcoin's continued existence is that we don't live in that world anymore, and you have to ask the question, why? And the answer to that is that nationalist politicians and policymakers very self-consciously came to see the existence of private currency creation, private money creation, as a threat, as something that was incompatible with the needs and the majesty of the modern nation state.
Well, give me a concrete example. What was their problem?
The problem during the Civil War was that you needed to pay for the cost of the military campaign.
Right.
And thus, you needed, in this case, to print money. And the idea of printing money worked best if that was the only currency in circulation.
Yeah, so only we can print money.
Precisely.
And well, I'm beginning to see why these people are suspicious
of course,
of the Federal Reserve.
Absolutely. There's a long, fascinating history here of why people who would equate private currency creation with individual liberty would clearly see this as an abridgment of that liberty. But the fact is, the liberty was abridged. The private currencies were taxed out of existence through federal law in 1866. It's not about whether this was a good idea or a bad idea, or whether it paid economic benefits or whether it didn't. What matters is that it happened and that it set in motion a consolidation of power on the national level that for Bitcoin, they should be well aware is very difficult to challenge.
Well, wait. Hold on now. Are you saying that, you know, the dead
iron hand of the past is going to lock us into a course of action? I mean, things change.
Well, the question of why can't we return to this storied past of private currencies, many of which work reasonably well, the question that a historian has to ask is, have we gone from where we were in the Civil War, and are we now back in the antebellum era where there's a perception that there's that we can shrink the federal government to something almost insignificant and there'd be no need for monetary policy, no need to deal with unemployment, no need to deal with any of the policy challenges that modern industrial and post-industrial nations face today. And I don't see us living in the 1850s.
So it seems to me you're saying, look, the state, it took them decades to establish a single fiat currency. They're not going to let go of the control that comes with that.
That's correct. And I think the representatives of the government would obviously and have already expressed concern about Bitcoin in terms of the language of 9/11, of fears of money laundering and the like. That this is a real threat somehow because of terrorists and the like. And there may be some truth to that. What probably, though, underlies this is a more subtle, diffuse, and maybe even, at least for those who speak it, unconscious defense of existing prerogatives, and frankly, a defense of existing policy tools for those in the Fed and the Treasury Department and in the executive branch generally, that, no, you don't actually want the dollar being fundamentally challenged in some deep way. So there's an earlier example, I think, where we can look at of a moment when the government said one thing, but if you really look at the facts, it suggests that it was really about propping up the majesty of the state. And that's after the Civil War, when the government relentlessly pursued counterfeiters. Now, that's necessary. You can't have a fiat currency and have it counterfeited. If you have that happen, you know, you see depreciations. You got to protect your currency. And they did that via the Secret Service. Well, the Secret Service was so good at crushing counterfeiters that by the 1880s, 1890s, it had largely gotten rid of most significant counterfeiting threats. So what'd they do? Well, there were other people who were printing money and making coins, chocolate coins, actually, candy manufacturers who were making chocolate coins that were similar to, say, a dime or a quarter or a dollar. And what is the secret?
We call that Hanukkah guilt in my family.
Exactly.
Steve.
Well, the Secret Service called that counterfeiting. And it went and literally roughed people up, threatened them with prosecution, prison time, and shut people down.
So what you're saying is this was the equivalent of defacing the flag.
Precisely.
This was an insult to the majesty of the power of the national government.
Right. But it was framed at the time as we're worried about counterfeiting.
Right. Right. I got it. So look, we're both historians. We both appreciate the grip of the past on actions. But talk to me about the introduction of credit cards. I mean, weren't there lots of people who said, oh, this is never going to fly, this isn't going to work? Couldn't we look at Bitcoin as simply the next turn of the screw in terms of how people pay for things, maybe making it even more fluid than the dollar?
Absolutely. The question you have to ask, though, is for a currency that trumpets itself as being effectively a slap in the face of the state, let's say that it is permitted to continue to exist, but only under heavy regulation and through precisely the same sort of monitoring and oversight that credit cards and actually other existing digital currencies now have to face. It will then exist, but it will have lost its revolutionary promise to effectively overturn state power. In other words, credit cards are heavily, heavily monitored, especially after 9/11, with a staggering level of oversight that makes it very difficult to use them in any way that can be considered revolutionary.
No, that's why criminals use cash, not credit.
Exactly. And so I could definitely see a situation where perhaps Bitcoin and other digital currencies are permitted to exist, but the idea that something is permitted to exist kind of is a defanging of It's sort of like, yes, it's you've got a very nice currency here. It'd be a shame if anything bad ever happened to it. You know, I mean, so if you do what we tell you to do and monitor this and register that, you can exist. At that point, though, is Bitcoin the kind of disruptive technology that's going to overthrow the Fed? I just don't see it.
Stephen Mim is a historian at the University of Georgia. You can read the op-ed he wrote for Bloomberg News about the problem with Bitcoin at backstoryradio.org. I'm Brian Bellow.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Peter Onuf. Throughout much of U.S. history, gold has been, well, the gold standard when it comes to money. The idea was that gold had intrinsic value, natural value. Some people argued that God had intended gold to be money just as he'd intended coal to be fuel.
Often they would talk about a kind of evolutionary development in the history of money where primitive peoples used base metals for money, copper or bronze or iron tokens, and then they evolved towards gold.
This is historian Mike O'Malley. He's written about how in the first half of the 19th century, the U.S. government only issued money in the form of gold and silver coins. Private banks did issue paper money, but the idea was that you could always take that paper money to the bank and redeem it for specie, hard currency.
Then, during the Civil War, the U.S. government did something radical. It began issuing paper money called greenbacks to finance the war effort. Greenbacks weren't backed up by gold or silver in a vault somewhere. Instead, their value came from the fact that the government said they had value.
Mike O'Malley says this new approach to money horrified a lot of people because it raised a troubling question. Is value intrinsic or is value created by the government?
One of the interesting things about the gold debate is that it's, as you said, it's based on the idea that gold has some sort of natural intrinsic value. It just is valuable. In that way, it's very similar to the way some people argued about racial difference, that there was a natural intrinsic racial difference. There was an intrinsic superiority to white people. There was an intrinsic inferiority to black people. And the rhetoric is often very similar in terms of a natural hierarchy, the interest in finding a natural hierarchy.
Are there any really specific examples of that overlap in rhetoric that you can tell us about?
Yeah, the most interesting, I think, to me was that when Lincoln announced or decided eventually that he would allow black men to enlist in the Union Army to become soldiers, it's roughly the same time as greenbacks enter into circulation.
Right.
And Lincoln's opponents particularly frequently compare greenbacks to Negro soldiers, is the term they use.
You got to explain that.
No, it made no sense to me either. What does a black man in uniform have to do with a paper dollar? And I think the argument that you see it in minstrel show songs, you see it in campaign songs, you see it in editorials, is that black men in uniform were being artificially endowed with a value they didn't naturally possess. They were being inflated. They were beyond their natural
place. By the Union, no less.
Right. Right, by the Union. The Union was endowing them with a value or claiming they had a value they didn't actually possess in the same way it was calling paper money and endowing paper with a value it didn't naturally possess.
Now, when I think of the people who are obsessed with gold, I think of a bunch of bankers in New York or New England. I don't think of Confederates per se. How much overlap was there between the folks who wanted to see essential value in their money and the folks who claimed there was some essence to race?
There's a very strong affinity. The people in the North who supported greenbacks also tended to support racial equality. It's very clear the radical Republicans, people like Thaddeus Stevens or Ben Butler, strongly favored the idea that equality was a social condition. If you declare people equal, they become equal.
So look, we don't get credit cards till the 20th century, but are you arguing that there was a plastic moment, so to speak, from the Civil War through Reconstruction that really provided openings for quite different and innovative ways of seeing both the value of money and race?
Yes, I do think that there is a tradition in American life long before the civil rights movement of the 50s that gives room for constructing racial equality. So I think as a result, Americans are willing to reconsider citizenship in pretty radical ways. And you see that in the way, say, Thomas Nast will draw Black Americans. He'll draw them with dignity, standing upright with classical features or semi-classical features. He sees them as worthy citizens and also as having earned citizenship, being entitled to it. And that moment is powerful. It's not clear how much that represents majority sentiment or how deep it goes, but I think it's overwhelmingly there. And it persists in some aspects of the debate about money.
I would imagine that Reconstruction was in many ways the heyday for bringing these arguments together. I mean, after all, you had you had federal troops occupying the South. The greenback was still in circulation, and you had real aggressive efforts on the part of the radical Republicans to make African Americans whole as citizens.
Yes, that's where you see really pronounced racialization of the money language. And I could give an example from the journalist James Pike talking about South Carolina. The white race rules, he says, by virtue of its intrinsic strength, while the newly freed Negroes rule South Carolina by means of an alien and borrowed authority. It is not the rule of intrinsic strength. It is the compulsive power of federal authority in Washington. Under this rule, he says, the vote of any Negro in the state is worth as much as a South Carolina bond. So Pike is saying that the government of South Carolina, that the votes of black people are equal in value to its financial products. That is, they're worthless. They aren't backed by any intrinsic value or any intrinsic strength. They're pure paper pronouncements.
Mike, I want to ask you a question as we move forward. The gold standard wins out. America restores a dollar linked to gold in the early 1870s. But what becomes of attitudes towards race once America has its money restored to the essential natural state of things with gold backing up the dollar?
I just think it's inescapable that the moment of the greenbacks, the moment of interest in greenbacks, is relatively fleeting. And the restoration of the gold standard is very closely accompanied by the restoration of white supremacy in the governments of the former Confederacy. It's in fact referred to as redemption, which is the term you would use if you took a piece of paper money and got gold in return. The people who overturned the rule of Reconstruction in the South called themselves redeemers. And that's, I don't think that's the redemption of Christ. That's redeeming paper money. So the return to the gold standard was very much a return to, people would say, the natural hierarchy of things.
Now, we have an African-American president now, and he's not the head of the Federal Reserve, but he certainly has a lot to say about fiscal policy. What are the connections drawn today between race and money, and the essence of money and the essence of race?
As soon as Obama's elected, there's an enormous boom in the price of gold. The price of gold shoots up. And more than that, you see right-wing talk shows, radio shows, TV programs, gold. Advertisements for gold are the major source of income. They're a major source of revenue. And it's clear that for a lot of people, Obama represents a kind of social inflation, I think. He's the wrong kind of person. That may mean that he's the wrong kind of person because he's too educated or he's—
He's a socialist, Mike.
Right,
he's a socialist. That's why gold shoots up.
Well, that's part of it. And certainly the Federal Reserve does print more money. And you could argue that there's reason to be worried about inflation. It's not a completely irrational worry. But the inflation fears are always cast when you talk about Obama in terms of Zimbabwe-style inflation. And if you read—
But didn't Zimbabwe have a runaway rate of inflation?
They did. They did.
I understand you're implying it's because it's a country in Africa.
I am. And they don't say Weimar-style inflation, which is maybe the more famous form of inflation. I am implying that. If you Google Obama and dollar, you'll see all sorts of caricatures of Obama on dollars that are worthless. They'll have the picture of Obama where the president would be, and the dollar will be either worth nothing or worth some impossible trillion amount of money.
And are you saying that didn't happen with, let's say, Bill Clinton?
Probably some of it happened. I think it didn't happen to the degree or the extent that it did with Obama. And I think it's not that there hasn't been. One of the interesting things about Obama's presidency is there hasn't really been any inflation. There hasn't been significant inflation.
No, in fact, the main concern is deflation.
Right. But nevertheless, if you would look at the right's reaction, it was overwhelmingly inflation fears, very much the way inflation fears were behind the anxiety about black soldiers in the Civil War. So it's a dangerous territory. I don't want to simplistically say that people who oppose Obama are racist. I think that would be wrong. I think there's an element of our racial heritage in the way Obama is linked to the dangers of inflation.
But Mike, what about all the talk about post-racialism? What about all the talk about endless opportunity? Doesn't that offset or balance whatever lingering essentialist notions there are out there?
I think the thing that makes American society dynamic and interesting and energetic and productive is the oscillation between the idea that we can be whoever we want and the dream of knowing who we really are, of having stable identities. You can't resolve that tension. You can't. You know, the great thing about the United States is its dynamic economy. It's an economy that enables a lot of self-transformation for a lot of people. You can overstate that, but the principle that no one need be confined by the circumstances of their birth is a central and very important principle of American life. It's a little nervous-making, too, though, because if there is no – if no one's confined by the circumstances right. of their birth, if anybody can be whatever they want, then there's no natural hierarchy and there's no substance to what people become.
Right.
So the idea that gold is the store of real value is very comforting to a lot of people, and the idea that nature has installed a hierarchy in types of persons is very comforting.
Michael O'Malley is a historian at George Mason University. His book is Face Value, The Entwined Histories of Money and Race in America.
Peter, Ed, I really enjoyed talking to Mike, and some of the parallels that he draws between money and race were just fascinating. But you know what? It seems to me that the whole second half of the 19th century, if we get back to our topic of money, mm-hmm. is actually about silver, something yeah. that we didn't mention at all. Now, the greenback was not backed by anything. It was a fiat currency.
The faith of the government.
Exactly. The people who wanted the dollar to be linked to gold wanted it linked to something that was essential and that was in very limited supply.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ed, I'm going to put you on the spot, but it seems to me that those who began to argue that the dollar should also be linked to silver wanted the dollar linked to something real, something that came out of the ground, something that was kind of hard to mine, but not something as limited as gold, something that could grow as the country grew so that the currency could grow.
Yeah, so the idea is that silver is the compromise currency. Greenbacks are the currency of the wild-eyed farmers who want to have inflation regardless of good business practice and international standards. Gold is the product of those who want to hoard everything to themselves and drive up interest rates. Silver is the compromise metal. It's still precious,
yeah.
but there's so much more of it that it will allow prices to rise, which is what farmers and other producers
right.
want, but it will also keep the currency based on something other than just what the government says it is.
Yeah, and I think that middle position seems so commonsensical in this era of bipartisanship, I mean, of
right.
partisan polarization. Let's come together in the sensible middle. But those are mutually exclusive positions, the gold bug position and the inflationary greenback position.
And Peter, I'm screwing in my monocle here.
Yeah.
But to take the side of the bankers. But it is true, mm-hmm. those bankers, the money they were lending to the mm-hmm. farmers, they needed to get that
oh, yeah.
from European sources.
Absolutely.
And there was no way that a lot of those European countries were going to take bogus dollars, as they called them,
yeah,
back
right,
in return
right.
for
point.
Their solid European currencies.
Yeah.
So, Brian, how does this work out?
Well, the economy comes close to collapsing in 1893.
Yeah.
Despite that deep recession, the gold bugs, they believe in gold more firmly than ever. They rally behind the presidential candidacy of McKinley in 1896. And arrayed on the other side are those populists who have fused mm-hmm. with the Democratic Party. They line up behind William Jennings Bryan, who wants to use silver as the specie that the dollar is pegged to.
And this is the great morality tale of 19th century politics, because Bryan talks about being crucified on a cross of gold. The future of the soul of America is at stake in this great debate, and the Democrats lose.
They get killed.
And there is something else going on. One of the great stories about the populace, Ed mentions them. And those are those farmers. We think, oh, ignorant farmers, what do they know? But they actually envision much of the social legislation of the 20th century.
Right.
And that includes currency. There's going to be concessions to that populist position. That's one of the great ironies of populism. They lose to win.
And the way they win, Peter, is they convince Congress with the Federal Reserve Act to set up a series of banks that will adjust the supply of currency and put that currency in all these banks in different places, not just New York, but around the country, put that currency where it is needed. And the real takeaway here really goes back to that discussion with O'Malley, because O'Malley is talking about, is money essential? Do mm-hmm. we have to link it to nature? Did God mm-hmm. intend gold to be in charge? Or can man manipulate money to serve man? And at the heart of the populist cause was the notion of, we can do something about this.
Right.
We don't have to keep working 12 hours a day and making less and less. Yeah. We can just adjust that money supply. And by the progressive era, in the beginning of the 20th century, we now trust a set of experts to make those adjustments rather than trusting God.
Isn't that the big difference, Brian? Because this was the era of expertise, of management, and that is the new version of nature. That's the new version of God. And that is, we have the right people who know what they're doing, because we don't really understand the economy.
It's time for another quick break. When we get back, we'll ask what Benjamin Franklin would think about being the face on our $100 bill.
You're listening to Backstory, and we'll be back in a minute. This is Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Brian Ballow.
And I'm Ed Ayers. Today on the show, we're looking at the range of ways that money has held value for Americans over the course of our history.
We've received a number of interesting questions and comments on our website, and as always, we've invited a few of the people who posted there to join us on the phone. We've got Eric on the line with us from Seattle. Eric, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you. So my question is about collecting or hoarding money versus using it. Back when I was a child in the 70s, I remember being encouraged to clean out drawers of old coins, that these coins were costing the U.S. huge amounts of money, and yet now we have the government producing like these state quarters that encourage collecting. And I realized that for currency to be successful, the government needs us to both want it and yet spend it, and that's a really delicate balance.
So Eric is asking us to psychoanalyze the government, because the government is deeply conflicted, giving us conflicting cues about what to do with it, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
And what's happened when that balance is not there?
Mm-hmm. Brian?
Well, Eric, I got to tell you, for the most part, the government wants us to spend that money. It is true that they like to put pretty engravings on bills and coins so that we will appreciate the stature of the government.
And so those coins will appreciate in value.
So those coins will appreciate. But most of the hoarding has been done really in opposition to the government's best advice. I remember when my dad started hoarding JFK, I think they were half dollars.
Yeah, that's right.
Going to reduce the amount of silver content. Now, my dad was in the jewelry business. He knew what silver was worth. And I still remember where he hid those bags of silver dollars. Lyndon Johnson didn't like that. Lyndon Johnson made a statement.
To your father.
To my father and millions of other fellow Americans. Don't think you can hoard these because the government owns a lot of silver and we're going to flood the market with that silver for you hoarders out there. Now, I don't think Lyndon Johnson ever did that. But basically, the government's position is that money should circulate, because circulation helps
the economy.
I do think it's a good way to get children feeling guilty and conflicted about money, though, to say that those pennies in your penny bank are slowing down the economy. You're taking those away. But, you know, it's emblematic of a larger dynamic anxiety that we hear. Save, but don't save so much that you're bringing down the economy. Spend. Go out and go into debt. Buy that new car. Don't wait. So what I need to know, Eric, is what did you do? Are you one of those people that has huge bags of pennies stuck around the corners of your home?
I'm a little bit of a collector, but I don't think I go quite so far as hoarding.
You can be honest with us, Eric. I mean, sounds to me like you're right on the edge there.
The classic miser counts it up on a regular basis. What's the latest accounting?
I've got a couple pounds of pennies.
Oh, come on. Pounds. But now, what does that mean in dollars?
But then, of course, there's also the way of collecting it in the bank, which is not quite the same thing.
Ooh, now you're onto something, because you're getting into virtual values now, aren't you? Because the things you have in the bank, it's just a bunch of electronic information. Believe me, the bank is using it.
Yeah, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay, it's circulating.
If it's a savings and loan, that means that bank is lending that money, possibly even to people in the community to buy houses.
So, Eric, it sounds to me as if you may not be a hoarder but a collector. And I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about what is it that the coins mean to you?
And have you talked to your therapist about it?
And do you pay him in pennies?
Well, I mean, I think that coins especially, I mean, they do have a tie to history, from the old Lady Liberty, you know, half pennies to the Indian head cents and the buffalo nickels.
Yeah.
You know, I was born after JFK was assassinated, but there were those half dollars that did still have a little bit of silver, and I remember them being in circulation, but then going away.
Yeah, because my father scooped them all up.
Yeah.
What I hear you saying, Eric, is that the coins not only reflect the moment in which they're created, but they're a very self-conscious reflection of American history. It's one of the few ways that we remind ourselves that the country had a history, that there used to be something before today.
So, Eric, one last question. We got to figure you out a little bit. You collect. Do you save, too, or is this a zero-sum game? If you collect, you don't save, because you're certainly not going to cash in on that collection.
Well, I guess I do save as well, but I also have recognized the value of what I collected when I was younger, and it sort of have it as a possible something that if I needed it, I could.
You're an investor.
We're going to call you a prudent sentimentalist. Hey, thanks very much for calling, Eric. It's been great talking with you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Eric.
Bye-bye.
In May of 1775, the Continental Congress convened in Philadelphia. The battles of Lexington and Concord had taken place a few weeks earlier, and war against England was inevitable. The delegates knew they needed to raise an army. But Congress didn't have any money to pay for a war. They didn't have the power to tax, and so couldn't raise any revenue. The solution they came up with was simple. They'd print their own paper money, the Continental Dollar.
Now, these Continentals were printed in denominations that would seem strange to us today. A bill could be worth anything from a sixth of the dollar to $80. But what was stranger was their appearance. Benjamin Franklin had been tapped to head up the design of the Continental Dollar, and he had covered the currency in birds, plants, and Latin mottos.
Benjamin Irvin is a historian who has written about the Continental Dollars. He told me that Franklin's imagery had a deeper purpose: to inspire trust in a paper currency.
Paper money was relatively rare in the colonies. There had been experiments with paper money in the past, but paper by its nature had no intrinsic value. And it was entirely unclear how the bearers of the continental currency would ever be able to redeem them for value.
Or you might say it was unclear where the buck stopped.
Absolutely. Franklin had to build faith in the currency. He had to convince the American people that it would have value, and he did so by trying to convince them that the war was a war they could win and that was a war that would make them profit. He did so by essentially conveying three or four different messages on the Continental Bills. First, bills encouraged the people, the American people, to adopt economy and thrift. His most famous bill, perhaps, was his half-dollar bill, which depicted a sundial, the sun moving across the sky around the sundial, the Latin motto, Fugio, I fly, and the English motto, mind your business. Time flies, so mind your business. Get to work. Mm-hmm. It also told the American people that the colonies are united. The $8 bill depicted a harp with 13 strings, some of them great strings and some of them small strings.
That
just
would
like
be Delaware.
Great,
yeah.
That would be the Delaware's the small string. Great and small strings sound harmoniously together. We are in unison in our opposition to Great Britain. On his $6 bill, he depicted a beaver very diligently felling a large tree. And this persevering beaver represents the American people if they apply themselves and work. And then on your higher denomination bills, such as the $30 bill, Franklin depicted a laurel wreath upon an altar. And Franklin explained that this wreath was the reward for Congress if it acted righteously.
So, in effect, these are messages to the people, and many of these messages, as you've described them, Ben, are stories, stories of what's happening and how the American people can relate to what's happening. They're highly moralistic. It's about the poor victims of British tyranny. But they're in effect promissory notes, wouldn't you say? That is, hey, guys, get with the program here, fight the story, be the beaver, be whatever— we will triumph and you'll get paid off.
Absolutely, that's the case. These are emblems of America's rising glory, the promise of a revolutionary resistance. Franklin believed that visual images had the capacity to make what he called, quote, impressions upon the mind. Mm. In 1779, he explained exactly what he had set out to do with the Continental Currency. He wrote, quote, put on one side some important proverb of Solomon, some pious, moral, prudential, or economical precept, the frequent inculcation of which, by seeing it every time one receives a piece of money, might make an impression upon the mind, especially of young persons, and tend to regulate the conduct.
And Ben, that's partly the case, and it's very hard for us to understand because there are so few images in circulation, whereas now we have a surfeit of images and they mean nothing.
Images are constantly around us, and consequently they, like currency when it's in too much supply, are depreciated. But in the colonial world, images were much more rare. There were no billboards. There weren't buses or cabs streaming by with visual graphics displayed across them. And so currency, because images were so scarce, because currency was novel, but also because the Continental Currency explained on its face the value of its terms—
Right.
The bearers actually had to read it. We know what a $1 bill means today. We know what a $5 bill means today. But in 1775, if I were to hand you a piece of paper, this is from the Continental Congress, Peter, I'd like to buy a rooster, you would look at it and say, what does this signify? How much is this worth? I have to read it to understand. And while I'm reading it, I am observing this emblem from which I, if Franklin is correct, can take moral instruction.
Yeah. So, Ben, I get Franklin's idea, but did it work?
Well, in one sense, it didn't work. The Continental Congress was obliged by the expense of war to print massive sums of money, $240 million of money before the end of the war. And this emission of vast sums of money naturally depreciated the currency. But in another sense, it did work. In the sense that it financed a war and kept the Continental Army in the field, however so naked, however so underfed, until the influx of French money and arms could help bring the Continental Army to its victory at Yorktown. By accomplishing that much, the Continental Currency was a tremendous success.
So, Ben, what would Franklin think about being pictured on the $100 bill?
I think Franklin would be horrified to find himself on the $100 bill, and here's why. Writing several years after he printed the Continental Currency, Franklin expressed disdain for money that perpetuated what he called, quote, the dull story that everybody knows, and what would it have been no loss to mankind if nobody had ever known that George III is king of Great Britain, France, and Ireland, etc., etc. In other words, Franklin didn't admire currency that celebrated these heroes. He saw that as a lost opportunity. If Franklin were designing currency today, he would create emblems that reminded bearers, reminded the people who carried that currency to work hard, to be careful with their finances, and ultimately to put their faith in the United States, I have to believe.
Benjamin Irvin is a historian at the University of Arizona and one of this year's resident fellows at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. His book is Clothed in Robes of Sovereignty, The Continental Congress and the People Out of Doors. We'll post images of some of the continental dollars Ben described at backstoryradio.org.
Well, Peter, this Ben Irvin fellow may think that he's got a direct line into what Franklin might have thought about being on the $100 bill. But there are two sides to this banknote. I happen to talk to my own expert, and my expert says that Franklin would not have minded in the least.
I don't know. He's pretty full of himself. You know? He was ambassador, you know, to France. He was
so that was false modesty, that stuff about not putting political leaders on the currency.
Well, he probably didn't want John Adams on there.
Yeah, 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 yeah. The man behind that voice is Thomas Hipchin, formerly of the U.S. Bureau of Engraving and Printing. And the reason he knows a thing or two about Franklin is that back in the 90s, Hipchin was tapped to be the lead engraver on the Bureau's updating of the $100 bill. That was the first of a series of currency updates that would take place over the next several years. It was an effort to stay ahead of counterfeiters. Every bill except the $1 bill ended up getting a facelift. Now, if you remember what our money used to look like before 1996, you might have the same question about these revisions that I had. What's with the bigger and bigger and bigger heads?
I think the size of the portraits are related to the idea that people are hardwired to look at people's faces, and a larger portrait gets people to look at it more.
Why does that matter?
Well, if you don't look at the currency, you'll never know whether it's counterfeit or not. It's it's important that people look at it.
Do you think there's
and also it gives you a sense of trust? You know, you're looking someone in the eye. You know, that's kind of interesting, don't you think?
Now, I have to confess that you know I don't really look at my money very carefully. Have you ever observed anybody looking at their money? Have you ever pushed a $10 bill into someone's hand and said, wow, this is beautiful?
If you try to spend a $100 bill at a flea market, they're going to look at it.
Yes, I agree. Hey, I got to ask you, why no redesigned $1 bill?
We're prohibited from redesigning the $1 bill by Congress.
Why is that?
Well, there are 10 zillion vending machines, and the vending machine lobby is very large. This came down when we were doing all the redesigns. You know, we threw the $1 bill into it, and we were doing some redesigns for that. And I even engraved a portrait for it. But then it suddenly came down and said, hey, no, we can't be working on the $1 bill. That's not allowed. And we went, what?
So our listeners don't have a lot of money, but what would you tell them to do the next time they take a $20 bill out of their wallet?
Well, I'll tell you, when I first started at the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, the plate printers would take any new note they got and they would put a little tear in it because it was their job to make all the new notes.
All right, hear that, backstory listeners? A little tear in the money. It's a full employment program.
Yeah.
That's going to do it for us today. And as it always does, the conversation will continue in the digital realm. We'd love to hear your thoughts about today's show. Leave us a comment at backstoryradio.org. Don't be a stranger.
Max Story is produced by Tony Field, Jess Angabretson, Nina Ernest, Andrew Parsons, and Jesse Dukes. Emily Charnock is our research and web coordinator, and Jamal Milner is our engineer. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major support for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation. Additional funding is provided by Weinstein Properties and History Channel. History made every day.
Brian Ballow is professor of history at the University of Virginia. Peter Onuf is professor of history emeritus at UVA and senior research fellow at Monticello. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.